that I could continue last week of using the 2009 PowerPoints, or I can go back to talking and, you know, sort of some mix of lecture and Blackboard and conversation. Do people have any preference between those?
I would rather have the PowerPoints off.
Anybody else? All right.
Get the PowerPoints.
Then,
I'll figure out where you work. This is assuming the machine works. Discuss the basic logic of confidence results, which are one of the things you see all the time in statistics. And I'm going to start out by doing the coin flips, because coin flips are a nice, easy probability theory kind of thing to think about. And the basic logic is that you have something called a null hypothesis, which in this case would be that it's a fair coin, that the coin will come up heads half the time and tails half the time. And you have some evidence. For example, you flipped the coin 10 times and got 7 heads. You'd like to decide whether the hypothesis is true or not. Or putting it a little more precisely, how strong evidence this is against its being true. And in doing that, you have to have in the back of your mind some alternative hypothesis. So that, for example, if your alternative hypothesis is the coin comes up heads 0.5001% one of the time, and tails 0.49999 of the time, you're going to have a very hard time distinguishing that from a fair coin. But suppose your alternative hypothesis is that the coin is not fair and you don't know in which direction. So the alternative hypothesis is it either comes up heads more often or tails more often. And the usual form of what you're doing in this kind of statistics is asking, if the null hypothesis is true, how likely is it that the evidence against it would be as strong as it is? So in that case, 7 heads is what you got. 8 heads would be even stronger evidence. 9 heads would be even stronger evidence. 10 heads would be even stronger evidence. 7 tails would be just as good evidence as 7 heads if we're not making an assumption about which way the coin is biased. So the form of that question is to ask, how likely is it if it's a fair coin that the result would be 7 or more heads or else 7 or more tails? You want to sum those, I guess, 8 possibilities. Make sense so far? So that's very straightforward, but I'm not going to do it, but you can work out the calculation. The probability theory is a fairly simple formula that you can calculate for yourself. How likely are those results with a fair one? And suppose that the answer is that if it's fair, the chance of it being that far off, 50-50, is less than 0.05. Right? Less than 0.20. You would then say that the null hypothesis has been rejected at the 0.05 level. And when you see confidence statements in statistical things, they all have that general form. What does that mean? The mistake a whole lot of people make is to think that means that the chance that the null hypothesis is true is only 0.05, and that's not true. That's a common misunderstanding. The problem is that statistics can't tell you what you want to know and you want to believe it can. And let me see if I can show you the distinction between the probability of your result given the null hypothesis and the probability of the null hypothesis given your result. Make sense of those in principle? And my standard example is to imagine I pull a coin out of my pocket. And without looking at my, this time I'm going to have a definite alternative hypothesis, namely that it's double-headed. All right? Either fair coin or double-headed. And I flip the coin three times. And guess what? It comes up heads every time. If it's a fair coin, what are the odds of that happening? What are the odds that a fair coin will come up heads three times? That's fair. Okay. What are the odds it'll come up heads once? What are the odds it'll come up heads twice? What are the odds it'll come up heads three times? 1/8, right? Half by half by half. So, does that mean that having done this, I should say, well, the odds are 7 out of 8 that it's the double-headed coin? If your answer is yes, I would be happy to pull lots of coins out of my pocket until I get one of them where three coins go in pairs and then they can bet with you on the next one, because if it's double-headed, you know, you should be willing to give me very good odds. Right. Because why is it wrong? It's wrong because although the chance of a fair coin coming up heads three times in a row is only 1 in 8, whereas the chance of a double-headed coin is certainty, the chance that the coin I pulled from my pocket is double-headed is a whole lot less than 1 in 8. Because almost no coins are double-headed. All right, so that in fact, what we've got is one of two things has happened. I'm imagining that those are the only alternatives. One of them is pull a fair coin from my pocket. Happens almost all the time when you pull a coin from your pocket. Made a 1 in 8 chance. The other is pull a double-headed coin that ran into my pocket. 1 in 1 million, let's say. Got 3 heads. Sure thing. So we're comparing 1 chance in 8 to 1 chance in 1 million. Much more likely the 1 chance in 8 happened. So that's an important distinction because it means that although your confidence interval tells you, as it were, how strong the evidence is, it doesn't tell you what the conclusion is. Because the conclusion is that evidence plus whatever else you know. And there's, in fact, a variety of statistics, I don't think the book covers it, though I may be wrong, called Bayesian statistics, which actually formally does what I've just been doing. All right, so... So there.
But what does Bayesian statistics do?
Bayesian statistics does what I just did verbally. It says if you have a prior probability, that would be 1 in 1 million. If before doing the experiment you have odds that you believe in about how likely something is to be true, how you use the results of the experiment to modify those odds to learn from the experiment. So the example I just gave, if you believe that if you somehow knew from an exhaustive survey that 1 coin out of 1 million was double-headed. You then take a random bunch of coins, pull a coin, flip it 3 times, get 3 heads. You then would say, all right, what is the relative probability of pull a fair coin and got 3 heads, 1 in 8, tiny, less than 1 in 8, because only 999,999 out of 1 million that was a fair coin. What's the ratio of that to the probability that I pulled a double-headed coin? 1 in 1 million, that's the ratio, that tells me how likely it is that the coin is double. That's what's called Bayes' theorem, is that way. I think I actually have some things in the telephone. So, as I say, what's going on, a lot of people who use confidence measures don't understand this and get that. So the reason is that unless you're paying careful attention, they sound like the same thing. The probability of the null hypothesis versus the probability of getting this result given the null hypothesis. but they're in fact quite different things. The probability of the null hypothesis is true is what you want to know, and it's therefore very tempting to think that's what the statistics tells you.
So let's go on. The confidence level tells you how strong the evidence is against the null hypothesis. Just as if you think about the legal context, you could say that here the witness says you did it, remembers that nice red shirt of yours, and we've done some studies of witness testimony, witnesses make mistakes, and in fact, with a witness that confident has only one chance in four of being wrong. Except that you were sitting in this class being observed by five other people at the point when the crime occurred 3 miles away. All right, well, the odds that that one chance in four witness misidentification happened are a whole lot higher than the odds that you have an identical twin who was pretending to be you while you committed a crime 3 miles away. All right, so therefore, we don't conclude you're guilty, even though in this hypothetical case, that one piece of evidence looks like it's three chances out of four. The other point that's worth noting is that the term statistically significant doesn't mean significant in an ordinary language sense. Statistically significant is a statement of how likely it is to have gotten this result if the null hypothesis is true, not a statement of how large the result is. So the example that I give there is imagine that I actually took a coin out of the pocket and flipped it 10,000 times. It will almost certainly turn out that there are either more heads or more tails by a number which is very unlikely to occur by chance. And the reason for that is that real coins are not exactly fair coins. Real coins are close to fair coins. Well, if a coin is 0.51 versus 0.49 odds, and you flip it five times, you're never going to notice. Flip it 10,000 times, and the effects are now going to become large enough so that you will observe them. So in that case, you would have a highly significant result of an insignificant difference. Does that distinction make sense again? Right. And it could go the other way around. You could have a case where somebody says, your evidence that you can imagine the following dialogue occurring with both people saying the truth. Someone has done a study of the effect of the death penalty on murder rates. And the first person says, you know, your study, clearly death penalty don't affect the murder rates. Why, look, your significance level is only, you know, 0.4. That's not a significant result. And the guy says, my result, best prediction we can give my result, is that every execution deters six murders. Those could both be true. The second is a statement about the size of the result, and the first is a statement about how confident you are about it. That makes sense. So you could say, my best estimate is 6, not 0, but that's 6 plus or minus 8. Speaking of this, obviously that's not a very precise statement. Similarly, if I flip this coin twice and get heads, just from that evidence, it looks as though it's a heavily biased coin. But it probably isn't, because I know most coins aren't. If I didn't know that in a sense, I would say that's evidence of a very biased coin, but it's very, very weak evidence, because a perfectly fair coin still has one chance in four of doing that. Right. So, difference between the size of the effect and the significance of the effect are not the same thing. So, I think I'm going to skip that one. The normal distribution and the z-table we mentioned before. You know that the distribution of heights is normal. You somehow know that the mean is 70 inches and the standard deviation is 3 inches. And we know the criminal is less than 5 feet 4 inches tall because he ran through a low doorway with the video watching his back, and you can see he was standing up and played him through that doorway and something like that. All right? And the suspect is 5 foot 3 inches. How good evidence is that? You know, one way of putting it is, how likely is it that a random person would be less than 5 feet? And the answer is that 5 feet 4 inches is 6 inches under the, is that right? 5 times 12 is 60. That is 6 inches under the mean, so it's 3 standard deviations. Sorry, deviation is 3. So it's 2 standard deviations off. So z is equal to minus 2 is 2 standard deviations below the mean, and you could simply look up on the z table. Yep.
It seems like it'd be pretty easy to find standard deviation of heights of, say, men in America.
Right.
But what about the coin flipping example? Like, what's
the answer is that we don't have to use the standard deviation because we can actually calculate the probabilities. It's not a normal distribution. But in the case of coin flipping, you can use probability theory to say what are the odds that if you flip it 10 times, you'll get 7. That's sort of one of the very basic probability theory thing. You just do it arithmetic, essentially. That doesn't require normal distributions, doesn't require statistics, it's just straight probability. Just like we just ran through the odds of getting 3 heads in a row, 1 in 8. Well, it's a little more complicated. The odds of getting 3 heads out of 4, for example, there are 4 different ways you can do it according to which one is the tail. Each of those ways has a 1 in 16 chance. If any sequence has any sequence of 4 results has a 1 in 16 chance, all right? So 4 times 1 in 16 gives you 1 in 4 chance of that.
So you just calculate the odds.
Just calculate the probability. That's, from my standpoint, really, coin flips are better because this stuff, you don't really know where the Z-curve table came from. You're sort of taking it on faith that somebody's calculated this out. Whereas, assuming you've done an hour of probability theory, more or less, you should be able to calculate all of this stuff out. Now, obviously, for 1,000 flips, it'll take a long time to calculate it out. But for 4 or 5 or 6 flips, it's the sort of thing that I think my kid could do when he was 9 or 10. Because he did a lot of D&D, and so he wanted to learn how to calculate probabilities. But anyway, so in this case, you could look it up, and that will tell you what percentage of the population will be below 5'4". And if the answer is 40%, then the fact that this guy is below 5'4" really isn't very much evidence that he's the criminal. Whereas if the answer, suppose it was 4'8" or something, then this guy is 4'7". Well, that looks pretty convincing, and the Z table will tell you just how. How likely it is that a man is. Can you see any problem with this way of doing it? Suppose we're actually imagining a trial, and here is the defendant, he's been brought up, and the prosecution says, look, this statistical calculation shows there's only one chance in 20 that a random person would be this short, so that's a good reason to suspect he's guilty. What ought your reply to the defense counsel?
Yeah. Maybe there's a reason that short people would be in that area of the city.
You've got a much better argument than that. There's a reason that short people would be in front of that particular court because the police were looking for short guys. Right? The police knew he was short. So he's not a random example. Right? This is a problem, entirely different context. I discussed this in my book, Future Imperfect or Future Technology, that one problem with having too much information, in a sense, is suppose, for example, we had complete DNA data. Suppose we had a data table showing everybody's DNA. And they bring in the defendant and they say, look, the odds that someone's DNA would match the blood stain this close are only 1 in 10,000. Sounds really impressive until you realize the way they got him was to check the million people who lived in the right area, 100 of them match it, pick the first guy and put him in front of the court. All right, so you have to think about those things in terms of uses and abuses of statistics. So, if you look up Z equal minus 2, it's 0.0228, which means about 2% of the equal potential. Right. And you could try it with other heights, just for fun, if you can understand. Central limit theorem, we discussed briefly before, that tells you for a sample of size n, the average of the sample is an unbiased estimate of the mean of the population. Then there's no particular reason why the average of the sample should be either higher or lower. And the standard deviation you would calculate from the sample is 1 over the square root of n of the actual standard deviation of the population. All right? Then, let me put it differently. The standard deviation you calculate from the sample is a measure of the standard deviation of the population. But the standard deviation, if you keep repeating this experiment of pulling n, the standard deviations of the means of those will be that standard deviation divided by the square root of n. So if we pick 100 people repeatedly, we've got a big population. So we took 100 people, measure their heights. take the average. Take another 100 at random, measure their height, take the average, etc. Now we look at those averages. The distribution of those will have the same mean, but a standard deviation down by a factor of 10. All right, because of the averaging out the effects. So that's sort of useful, because if you imagine that you're testing, yep.
Why a factor of 10?
That's square root of 100. Oh. I'm not planning to improve this. In general, I disapprove of learning things you can't prove, but I don't think, given the amount of time we've got to do statistics, that I can afford to stick for that. So it's a pretty simple rule. So if you want to see if the population mean really is 10, you can take a sample of 16. That sampled mean turns out to be 8. Its standard deviation is 2. And the question is, how likely is it, if the mean is really 10, that the mean in your sample of 16 would be only 8? And the answer is that the standard deviation for the mean of a sample of 16 is going to be a quarter of the total of the standard deviation for the population. So it's going to be about a half. Hence, your mean is 4 standard deviations off from the hypothetical mean of the population. That's an unlikely event. All right. So that makes you suspect that indeed the average is not 10. All right. That people follow that calculation. It's a fairly simple one. Law school version, our law students are unusually tall. Yeah, I guess they are. All right. Small thing. But law professors are usually short. So you take 1,000 people and 100 law students, and the average height of the whole population that you sampled is 70 inches with a standard deviation of 3. The law students at 71 inches, is that good evidence? The standard deviation of the height of people's height is 3 inches. What's the standard deviation of the mean of 100 people? Standard deviation for the population is, what did I say it was 3, I think? The standard deviation of the population is 3. If we take 100 people and average it, what's the standard deviation for that average? Pretty great.
3?
Is it?
Didn't you say it was 10? Because it's the square root of your samples? Or
divide by 10.
Divide by 10. All right, so point.
Does that make sense?
It's 0.3. Yeah.
Does it make sense?
No, why is
it not? Because if you take a sample of 100 people, the mean of that sample doesn't vary as much as the mean of a sample of one person does. Doesn't that make sense? The differences are going to average out the larger your group. If you took a sample of 1,000,000, you'd get a mean almost precisely on the mean for the whole population. If you take a sample of 1, okay, and the rule is that if the standard deviation, which is what happened with a sample of 1, is some number, the standard deviation for the mean of a group of such people is that number divided by the square root of the number. So if we take 100 people, the standard deviation of the mean height of 100 people is a tenth the standard deviation of the mean height of a person. Makes sense? Doesn't that make sense? So that means that for 100 law students, the relevant standard deviation is 3/10. We are therefore more than 3 standard deviations off. So, therefore, the z is 3.3. And you could then look it up and you would discover that the probability was low. Right. Let me go on to some very useful information if you ever contemplate a life of legal crime. Yep.
Is that always divided by the square root of 100? Or is it just because you had a sample or a population of 1,000?
No, you divide by the square root of the the size of the original population, we just assumed was big enough so we had a reasonably accurate estimate of its mean and standard deviation.
Just do the square root of the sample.
Square root of the number in the sample gives you the standard deviation for the mean of the sample. All right? So you're imagining you're taking a whole bunch of random groups of 100, taking their means and then plotting them out.
and you'll get a much sharper bell curve than if you just took individual ones. So this is my scheme for making a fortune. It's up there already. You're thinking of starting an investment newsletter. Everybody knows those are profitable things to start. Fortunately or unfortunately, you know nothing about what are good investments or bad investments. But that's all right. We can fix this problem. Because what you do is you get a mailing list of 8,000 customers, and you now write an investment newsletter. You can look at somebody else's investment newsletter to see what they look like. And you find some nice, safe, innocuous piece of advice, something everybody agrees about. All right? Interest rates are still going to be low next month. And you put that into all copies of your newsletter. But your newsletter has two versions. And one of the versions says Google stock is going to go up, and the other says Google stock is going to go down. I don't know, Google, to find some nice, volatile security. Some security, which is very unlikely to stay the same. And half your newsletter say it'll go up, and half them say it'll go down. And you keep track of who you sent which copy to. And you wait a week or a month or whatever offer you put out of your newsletter, and Google stock goes up. You cross off the name of the people you told it's going to go down. You prepare another newsletter with a similar pattern, 2,000 to one set, 2,000 to the other. See what happens, cross off 2,000 names. Repeat one more time, and you now have 1,000 customers who know that you've called it right 3 times in a row. Can't be chance, right? You've got to know what you're doing. So you now offer to give them a year's subscription to your newsletter for a hefty price, and you give lots of innocuous advice for the rest of the year. All right? Makes sense? Now, my guess is that nobody does this on purpose. You see the sense in which it happens not on purpose all the time. Let us all we require is that it's 1,000 customers each for 8 newsletters. And that they're all making fairly uncertain predictions. And the ones which get wrong a couple of times lose their customers and go out of business or maybe start another newsletter with a different name. And the ones that hit it right get a reputation. So the result is that it's not easy to tell. If somebody comes to you and says, look, here's my record. Look at how many times I've called it right. It's not trivial to figure out. He may be perfectly honest. He may believe it too. But you have to allow for the fact that you're observing the successes out of a very large numbers of tries, and by pure chance there would be some. Therefore, it's... Now, if he gets enough successes, you could say, well, look, if I can work it out, that he would have... There's only one chance in 10 million of that long a string of... There weren't 10 million newsletters out there. So that would be pretty good evidence. And that, in a sense, is what what's his name?
You know, Warren Buffett.
What Warren Buffett means when he says he's a 5-sigma event. He's saying he's too unlikely to occur by chance. That was his claim. And very obviously is true.
So similarly for proving that Diet Coke causes cancer, suppose you do the experiment that I have described. And you find the relation between Diet Coke and cancer is different at the 0.05 level. What is wrong with that as evidence that Diet Coke causes cancer? Better not send your clock. 0.05 level says there's only one chance in 20 that if Diet Coke doesn't cause cancer, we would have gotten this close, this good result, this strong result, this high relation between people drinking Diet Coke and getting cancer. Why is that not convincing?
Because
I've looked at 30 or 40 different foods, and if I look at 40 foods, you would expect one or two of them to make 1 in 20 random chances. All right?
And the technical term for this in the context of multiple regressions is a specification search. And what a specification search consists of is, I think that the death penalty deters murders. But I'm not sure of the details. Because, after all, there are lots of other things that affect the murder rate. So I'm going to get a list of 20 other variables, and I'm going to do something we'll get to later, a multiple regression with 20 variables in it, including death penalty, and see whether the death penalty term is significant. But, of course, I'm not going to just do this once, because I don't really know how all these variables are related. And, you know, maybe it's variable 1 times variable 2 that matters, or variable 1 plus variable 2, or variable 1 plus the log of variable 2. So
So I can think of hundreds of different ways of setting up my hypothetical relationship, in all of which I'm testing for the fact that the death penalty deters murder. And all I have to do is find one of them, which it comes out significant, I just report that and don't mention the others. All right. And the specification search, there is in fact software which will do this for you, which will try a bunch of different ways of running your regression and tell you which one's working. And the result of this is that the availability of cheap computers make confidence results much less convincing than they used to be. It used to be the case that actually doing a regression was a whole lot of work, just a lot of arithmetic, basically. And therefore, you'd be pretty sure that the guy who wrote the article had only done one or two or three regressions. Now he could have done 100 in an afternoon with no trouble at all and picked the best ones. So one solution to that, as I mentioned at the bottom, is that you don't just report your results. You put the data you got the results from up on the web along with a description of how you got the results. And then somebody else can take your data and say, but wait a minute, what if I ran this regression a different way? Oops, not significant. Another one. That's not significant either. I wonder what's happening. All right. So that's one real feature of the model. Correlation is not causation. Common phrase. Putting it differently, facts don't speak for themselves. Facts speak only through theories, such as some idea of what the pattern is. And this is a famous real example that at some point they put in a set of requirements, which I think seat belts and I think collapsible steering wheels, if I remember correctly, were the big ones. And people who studied accidents said, look, we can show that after the cars that have these things, your chance of dying in an accident is noticeably less than the cars that don't. Therefore, this requirement to save X thousand. And Helsman, being an economist, says, wait a minute. You're assuming that putting them in did not change how fast the drivers drove. But the safer the car is, the lower the cost to you of driving fast, of driving after you have one beer, of doing things that increase the chance of an accident. If you imagine that you were driving the perfectly safe car with, you know, this high-tech futuristic airbag where whatever you do, you're going to walk away from it. Well, your incentive to be careful is a good deal lower in that car. And Helsman said, this is a much milder version of that. But the relevant question is not how many accidents were there multiplied by the reduction in deaths per accident. We also have to figure out what the effect was on the number of accidents. So he did, again, fancy multiple regression, tried to determine what things determined accident rates, and found that, yes, indeed, the accident rate went up when these requirements went in, and it went up by about enough to cancel the decrease in deaths per accident. So that's one case where, similarly, I think we discussed last time the question on the death penalty one, and the naive, easy one is to compare states, and the problem with that is you don't know which direction the causation is going. There really, it could be that having a death penalty makes you more willing to commit murder. It could be that having high murder rates make legislatures more willing to approve death penalties. It could be that having a violent culture makes people both more willing to approve death penalty and more willing to kill each other. All of those are possible explanations of the correlation, so you can't tell by that alone. And again, we'll be getting to multiple regressions, which are in some better way. Kinds of errors, and you will notice that there are four possible outcomes, possible situations in the trial. He's guilty and we convict him. He's innocent and we acquit him. Those are the good ones. He's guilty and we acquit him, and he's innocent and we convict him. And we would like to increase the probability of the first two, reduce the probability of the last two, but we can't do that beyond limit in the world of imperfect information. Type 1 error consists of rejecting a true hypothesis, and type 2 consists of failing to reject a false hypothesis. So that's the trade-off. So if he is guilty and we acquit him, the hypothesis was that he was guilty, we acquitted him, so we rejected it, yes?
They talk about this in the book, but I didn't understand why it's significant. Why does it matter whether it's a 1 or a 2?
What matters is that there is a trade-off between the two, and that therefore, if you think it is very important to reduce type 1 errors, you're going to have to raise type 2 errors, and by more vice versa. Which you call them really depends on what you think of the hypothesis as being. Hypothesis is he's guilty or he's innocent. But we need some name for them. And given that you set it up as your hypothesis is that he is guilty, then that one's a type 1 error, and that's a type 2 error. Note, as I said, that we, according to how we set up our null hypothesis, we put it either way. But the critical point is you can trade them off. In the law, that's what the standard of proof is doing. The civil law is willing to convict more innocent people in order to avoid acquitting guilty people, because that's a lower standard of proof. Criminal law the other way. There's this famous statement, which I think goes back at least to Maimonides, but probably earlier. It is better that N guilty people be acquitted than that one innocent person be convicted. And N varies according to the statement. Nobody really has any very good basis for any particular such number, but that's really a statement about how you feel about the trade-offs you're willing to make between type 1 errors and type 2 errors. Similarly, in a statistical study, the higher the confidence interval you require, if you say 0.05, I'm going to throw out the result, it's got to be at least 0.01 before I'll pay attention to it. Well, in that case, you are likely to often fail to reject false hypotheses, but you will very rarely reject a true hypothesis. Right? So that's, again, a trade-off. Let me now go to the next slideshow, which is right here. I'm going to fix this. See if I can remember this time the right. All right, so we already ran through this stuff, which is normal distribution. Let me just go quickly, this was really reviewing. Central limit theorem we went through. Rent paid by law students at SCU. If you wanted to find out whether they really averaged about 1,000, you could take a sample of 100, do the same thing again. All right, calculate the mean of the sample. You calculate for each rent the deviation between that and the average rent squared, which is how you calculate standard deviation, add it up, divide by 99, because you use n minus 1 in estimating standard deviation from the sample, and take the square. All right? Let me, do people follow what I just ran through, or is it completely gibberish? We're trying to estimate. We have a hypothesis about the mean. All right? The hypothesis about the mean is, where I had it there somewhere, is $1,000. From the sample, we're going to estimate the standard deviation, which we do that by taking, in effect, the standard deviation of the units in the sample. We're not yet taking the standard deviation of the mean of the sample. We're just saying, all right, here are 100 people. If we just use those 100 as items from our distribution, what standard deviation will we calculate? And we have to push it up just a little bit, because as I said before, when you do that, since the mean you're using is not the mean of the population, it's the mean of the sample, that's all you've got. Therefore, your standard deviation is going to look a little bit too small, because if the mean of the sample is biased one way, so are the items in the sample. All right. So you therefore, the definition of the standard deviation is the sum of, for each observation, observation value minus mean value squared, divide that by the number of observations, or the number of observations minus 1 in this case, take the square root of that, and that's what standard deviation is defined as. So you can calculate that. Then, once you've got sigma, which is the standard deviation of the population, then the standard deviation of the mean is going to be a tenth of that, because this is a sample of 100. And then the question is, how likely is it that, and so forth, doing the same thing, going finally to a sigma. Right. Here are the hypothetical numbers from the book. Sample size is 100. The average for that 100 is 950. You calculate a sigma of $150 by looking just at the 100 in your sample. That's all you got. Sigma over square root of 100 is $15. That's going to be how much you would expect the mean of a sample of 100 to vary from one sample of 100 to another. All right? And that means that Z is 50 over 15, 3 and a third. and we're doing a two-tailed test, what does a two-tailed test mean? It means we want to know how likely it is that we would be off from the figure in either direction. That after all, if what we had gotten was not 950 but 1050, that would be just as good evidence as it wasn't 1,000. Right? The prediction is not 1,000, not if it was lower than 1,000. So testing that prediction is our alternative hypothesis. We therefore have to look at what's the chance that either it's either below 3.33 or below minus 3.33. That is on either extreme tail of that distribution. The Z table shows that below 3.33 is 0.995 of distribution. So that means there's only 0.005 above it. Because the total distribution is 1, probably it'll be something in city 1. And the same number at the other end. So you add up those two, and the answer is there's only one chance in 100 that your sample will be that far off by chance. Therefore, that's pretty strong evidence that indeed the average rank is not 1,000 numbers. But of course, it still doesn't tell you that that fact by itself, the fact that you got a highly significant result, doesn't tell you that there's a lot off 1,000. Yep.
If you were to have only had the standard deviation of the sample, but not the standard deviation of the population, would you be out of luck?
That's all you've got. In this case, what you do have, notice that there are two different standard deviations with regard to the sample. One of them is the estimate of the population standard deviation that you made from the sample. That wasn't from the mean of the sample, that was from the sample. All right? You say, calculate the standard deviation of the sample if the sample was the whole population. Except divided by n minus 1 instead of n. That gives you an estimate for the standard deviation of the population. Now divide by the square root of the number of items in the sample, and that gives you an estimate for the standard deviation of the mean of the sample. All right? It's a little tricky, but not horribly tricky. Yeah, I would advise you, this is what is in the book, and I would advise you to just go through the calculation at least once just by yourself, just so you can make sure you can really follow it and not just listen to the words. So the basic logic of hypothesis testing is you have a null hypothesis, the coin is fair, you have a sample, you have evidence, which is 7 heads out of 10, and you want to describe whether it's true, whether an hypothesis is true, and you're testing it against an alternative hypothesis. And the question is, if the null hypothesis is true, how likely is it that the evidence against it will be at least this strong? It will be at least this far. Doing. Confidence level tells you how strong the evidence against the null hypothesis is. It does not tell you how likely the null hypothesis to be true, nor does it give you a measure of how far from true it is. Right? If you flip the coin enough times, you get a very confident result for a very small difference. Yep.
So we said earlier, if you get a confidence level of 0.05, that's saying there's a 1 in 20 chance that it's not the null hypothesis, right?
No, that's a 1 in 20 chance that you would have got this result if the null hypothesis was true. You don't know what the chance is if it's not the null hypothesis. But the less likely the result is if the null hypothesis is true, the stronger evidence against the null hypothesis the result is. Does that make sense?
So
you can't do it number to number. They aren't the same thing. But when you tell me there's only one chance in a million that we would get this result of the null hypothesis were true, that's a stronger reason to change my opinion that it's true than if you told me there's one chance in 10. So, again, let's take the case of his alibi. All right. We do DNA testing. And the DNA testing says there's only one chance in a million. One chance in 10 million. That his blood would match the blood stain on the murder victim as closely as it does by chance. Well, if we really leave with 1 in 10 million, we start wondering if maybe his alibi is somehow hooked up. All right, maybe he does have a lookalike if he got to do with him, or an identical twin or something. On the other hand, as I mentioned before, that 1 in 10 million is bogus, because that 1 in 10 million is the chance that we got a misidentification through random variation in DNA. It's not included if we got this misidentification because the lab technician was drunk, or because the lab technician knew what the police wanted to find and wanted to keep his job, or you can think of various other factors. So in that sense, those probability figures for DNA are wildly overstated. But if the chance, if our first piece of evidence is that he's innocent, And our second unit of evidence that he's guilty is really, really strong evidence that he's guilty. We start retaking the first. But that doesn't mean you can just take the probability, take the confidence number, and turn that into a probability, because they're different things, right? The confidence number is telling you, if he's innocent, how likely is it that we have this strong evidence that he's guilty? That doesn't tell us how likely it is that he's innocent. Right? Does that make sense? Does that make sense? Because it's a mistake that people make all the time, and that's why I want to try and armor you against this SIP. And if you have to explain it to somebody else, use my example of pulling the coin out of your pocket and putting it in. Easiest way of making that distinction. All of this is sampling error, that is error due to the fact that you just happen to lift three heads or whatever, but other forms are, and that's the point I was just making, that we know there are far more mistaken DNA results than you could get from those calculations. So it's human error and fraud and such. Bayesian statistics, what I mentioned before. You start with the prior probability that a few coins are double-headed. I just went through this. The chance of drawing one and getting heads twice is much lower than the chance of drawing a pair of coin and getting heads twice, so the latter will be the end. And here is the formal version of it. I'm not actually writing out Bayes' theorem, but if one coin in 1,000, in this example it's worth 1 in 1,000,000, probability of pulling a double-headed coin from a box is 0.001. Double-headed, the probability of getting two heads in a row is one. So the joint probability, the probability that I will pull a double-headed coin and then get two heads is 0.001. 999 points are roughly there. 0.999 times 0.25, the chance of getting two heads. So the combined probability, the probability that I will first pull a fair coin and then put the heads twice, is 0.24975. We know one of those things happened. You can eliminate all other states of the world, as it were. And their relative probability is about 1 to 250, so the odds would be, on this, on these numbers, about 250 to 1 to 1 standard. All right? Three inputs will take it down to about
9.5. Why was this revolutionary at Bayes' time? I mean, it seems like an implication to me.
Seeing that you could use statistics to get from a prior to a posterior probability, the real answer is I don't know enough about the history of statistics. I know somebody who can answer that question, but he's in Chicago. Steve Stigler is the son of the economist George Stigler, is a historian of statistics. He used to be the chairman of the statistics department in Chicago, and this is exactly the sort of thing he talks about. So if you like, I will probably see him at some point in the next year or so for one reason or another, and I do want to ask him. I don't know how revolutionary it was. I just know that in the world I live in, people use statistics usually with one respect. And the statisticians know about stuff. So. Notice, however, that it does not show you how to find your prior probabilities. Those depend on knowledge of the situation modified by your past experiments. No prior, no posterior. How to lie, part two. Earlier. One way is to report your sampling error as if it was the only error and say there's only one chance in 10 million this guy could be. Then we would have this kind of match if he wasn't the murderer. One way is to report your confidence interval and reverse the meaning, what we were just discussing. And one way is to report a selected result. That my suspicion of when I hear advertising statements about, you know, how our product deemed everybody else's product. My suspicion is maybe it's true, but maybe they just went through everybody's tests and found the guy who won the mistake that they didn't miss. And even without trying, if you think about the academic world, boring results or results saying, I have a theory, I did not get any significant evidence for it, don't get published. So therefore, if you've got 100 people who are testing whether or not the capital punishment deters murder, to take one of the famous cases. If 100 people do studies of it, 99 of them, the way their study is done, they get no significant result. And one guy says there's only one chance in 100 that I could have gotten this strong result by chance. He's telling the truth, but his readers are going to get the wrong conclusion because they don't realize there was only one study out of 100 that did get those results by chance. And similarly, if you think about not the academic, but the popular world, if I, there was a story I saw today, which is I think that carbon or carbon dioxide causes, I don't think it was cancer, but something or other. And I have no idea if it's true, because, it, again, if 100 people studied the things, 99 got no result, even if they all published, only one of them would have made a headline in a newspaper. So only one of them would have gotten to me. And in addition, a further problem for the academic is that getting published is actually worth a lot of money in terms of your future career, and therefore you have an incentive to try to produce results that go as far as possible. The thing that got me my attention to this was a few years ago, there was some kind of an anti-rape campaign here, and there were some numbers that struck me as unbelievable being asserted on, you know, posters and such about what percentage of women, college women, got raped, and I traced it down. It was a study done by somebody who got a result that was something like 10 or 20 or 30 times as high as everybody else was studying it. And you then trace it further, and it turns out welfare definition of rape includes cases that victims do not consider rape. All right, there's this whole wide range from literal physical, you know, physical assault rape to regretted it afterwards. And she was pretty clearly deliberately taking the widest possible definition. Now, she may, I don't know if this was done for career purposes. It may have been variety, you know, she may have thought, well, rape's a big problem, I wanted people's attention to it. But equally well, she may have thought, I want to get a job at a better college than I'm at, and look at all the publicity this thing. She did get a lot of publicity out of that particular result, which was so high compared to the other results. So those are both problems. Yes, the one other thing you can do if you want to pursue the statistics is to lie. As you probably know, statistics prove that 95% of voting statistics are invented. If you believe that. Right. Let me now go on to something we'll be doing more of on Wednesday, which is multivariate statistics. And we're going to start with the relatively simple case where you've got two characteristics, and you want to know their relation. So, for example, one characteristic is, does this state have a death penalty? And one characteristic is, what's the murder rate? And that's one where the death penalty is a yes, no, the murder rate is a no. You could also get fancier. You could say, well, look, a death penalty doesn't matter very much if you never actually execute somebody. So you could say our two variables are what percentage of people convicted of murder are executed, and what is the murder rate. Those would both be different ways of looking at the same question. And the starting method, sort of the easy visual method, is what's called a scatter plot. And you can probably figure out for yourself what's being shown here. So if we imagine, for example, that this axis is murder rate, and this axis is percentage of convicted murderers who get executed, well, this is a state where the murder rate was low and a small fraction of convicted murderers got executed. This is a state where they're both high. This is a state where this one is low and this one is high, and so forth. Right, so you're just graphing points where one axis shows one of the variables and one the other. And you can then eyeball these. All right, you can look at them and say, does there seem to be some relation between those things? And you'll notice that this one, I think, if you look at it, you say, yeah, it looks like there is a not very sharp, but a relation like that. Now, this one is more interesting, because if you do the normal calculation we'll come to for a minute, which is supposed to say, are they related? Again, they're not related. But what do you think is going on there? What would you guess those points are telling you?
Yep. Is it that there's a third variable that's not shown?
That you've got two groups of things which differ on some third variable. Indeed, it looks like it's a third binary variable, a yes or no variable. I don't know what it is. Maybe the answer is that we're doing both states and provinces, and Canada and the U.S. are different. That would be a possible way of getting it. And it happened that the relationship goes this way, that in the U.S. the death penalty deters, and in Canada the anti-deters. That would be an example of what that kind of thing would show you. And part of the point, though, is that that suggests that sometimes looking at the graph is more useful than calculating the sorts of things that statistics calculate. That, as I make it here, humans come with extraordinarily good pattern recognition built in. It's a really good software that evolution gave us for doing that. So the mathematics of it is what's called a correlation coefficient. So you've got two things that are related. And the correlation coefficient is a measure of to what degree when one of the variables is away from the average in one direction, the other one is. So if it's true that people who are above average height are also above average weight, and you are experimental error, and I am experimental error, alas, but maybe the rest of people fit the pattern, but if that's the case, then you would tend to get a... You would tend to get a correlation coefficient which was positive, a positive correlation between the two. If it went the other way, suppose that rainfall and average temperature, suppose it was actually the case that cooler years had more rain, you would then get a negative correlation coefficient, so that if positive correlation is that when one of the variables is above its average, the other one tends to be, and a negative is that one's above, the other tends to be below. Alright? One is a perfect correlation, that's a straight line graph, one of them is proportional to the other, and minus one is perfect negative, straight line slopes down. And zero, as we saw a moment ago, is no correlation, but not necessarily no relationship, because this might easily have a zero correlation coefficient. Alright, because relation is more complicated than the linear relation, correlation coefficients. First one, you would get a positive correlation coefficient. Good deal scattered. And the second one, you probably wouldn't. Which of these two think has a higher correlation? Which is it more consistently true that if one of the variables is above the average, it's average, the other one is? The one on the right. That's right. This one, the relation is steeper. But just as what we were saying before, significance is not the same thing as the size of the effect. And similarly, the correlation, if we shifted this up to here, the correlation coefficient would be the same. The correlation coefficient doesn't tell you how steep the line is. It tells you how close to a line it is. All right? Make sense?
You said it again?
Yes, the correlation coefficient does not tell you how steep the line is. Indeed, the correlation coefficient is a pure number. It has no units. So it couldn't tell you how steep the line is, because how steep partly depends on whether you're measuring it, whether you're measuring your variable in degrees centigrade or degrees Fahrenheit.
So the higher the correlation coefficient, the tighter the data is?
That's right. Or the lower if it's below zero. The closer to plus one or minus one. So the plus and minus are sloping up or down, but not how steep it is. When you get to regressions, the regression coefficient will actually tell you how steep the slope is. But again, the useful distinction to keep in mind for all of these things between how tight it is and how large the effect is. And this is, if you want to look at it, I'm sure the book also gives you the actual mathematical definition of the correlation coefficient. You convert each of your variables to number of standard deviations from the mean. So you say, all right, the first point is the average murder rate is 5 in 100,000. The standard deviation is 1, we've discovered, and this one is 3 in 100,000. So it's minus 2. It's 2 standard deviations. Meanwhile, the number, the percentage of convicted murderers who are executed on average is such and such, it's standard deviation of 7. So for this state that we're looking at, that number is 1.5 standard deviations below. So we've got a minus 2 and a minus 1.5. Do that for every point, something plus some minus, obviously. And you then multiply those numbers together. Average over all the observations, but again, there's an n minus 1 instead of n for the same reason, I think, as before. And what that's saying is that if the above average value
go with above average values, the product will be positive. If below average values go with below average values, the product, those will be positive too, because a minus times a minus is a plus. So if you've got a correlation like this, you're going to have numbers down here going to give you minus times minus is plus. Numbers up here maybe plus times plus is plus. So all your terms are plus, so they're going to add up to a positive number. Going like this, the ones that are above average in one dimension are below average in the other, and therefore you've got a minus times a plus or a plus times a minus, so those numbers are mostly negative, so you end up with a negative correlation. Right? That's the, sort of the link between the mathematical process and so forth. Again, correlation need not be causation, because there could be a third variable that causes them. So, for example, driving an expensive car probably has very little effect on your life expectancy. Maybe if the sports car is negative, it's a sense that there's got lots of safety features are positive. But I would guess that driving an expensive car correlates with life expectancy. Why?
People who drive expensive cars can also afford
good
nutrient-rich foods, exercise.
Better food, good doctors, don't have to go out in the rain when it's cold, stuff like that. Yeah, that's right, because you would expect that. Height has little effect on having children, but the number of children when it's born is almost certainly negatively correlated with the height of adults. Why? Take a random sample of adults and ask each one how many children are you born. And how tall are you? And I claim you'll get a negative correlation. Why do you get a negative correlation? Oops. How many children have you born? No one in this room has born any children at all. And men are taller than women. Alright? Adults who have born children are all women. Women on average are shorter. So it's a spurious correlation. The real variable is gender or sex. And furthermore, there might be other factors. There might be a real correlation which you're not seeing because there are third factors going the other way. So it might be the case that you found no correlation between murder rates and death penalties by states, but the reason was that yes, the death penalty deters murder, but on the other hand, murder increases the chances of having death penalty. Those two effects would be canceled out, you then wouldn't see a correlation. So you could think of all of those things possible. And causation need not give correlation. Both of these would have correlation coefficients close to zero. We ran through that one before, and you can see what's happening. This is a very tight connection, but it's not a linear connection. All right? Which, again, is why you want to look at the scatter plot and not just at the correlation coefficients. Correlation will predict if the state has a death penalty, probably has a high murder. If you had a positive correlation, it doesn't matter for predicting whether the reason is that states with high murder rates have death penalties or the reason that states with death penalties have higher murder rates. It doesn't matter which direction the causation goes if all you want to know is. All right. Similarly, if I'm told that this adult has more children, that predicts that this adult is below the average height for adults. Not a confident prediction, but a prediction. But, of course, if you have the causality wrong, you might get the prediction wrong. Because you might be missing other things, but taller females aren't young.
Would it be possible to calculate the correlation coefficient for nonlinear?
It wouldn't be a correlation coefficient. There are ways of doing the equivalent. In particular, you can do a linear regression which is nonlinear in the sense that you're doing it A plus bx squared, say, instead of x. You can do the equivalent of linear regression that way. So there are ways of analyzing that kind of curve, but it isn't strictly the correlation coefficient.
correlates with being in the hospital, but it does not follow that if you don't want to die, you should stay in the hospital. And similarly, the death penalty might correlate positively with the murder rate, but that doesn't tell you whether to impose the death penalty that will raise your mortality, because that depends on which direction the causation is going. All right, linear regression is something in which you're actually trying to estimate the line that things come close to, so you're now getting information both about how nearly linear it is and about how strong the effect is. All right, this is sort of what a lot of statistics consist of, except a lot of it is more than two variables. So we want to count both too high and too low. So the way you do it is that what we're minimizing is the sum squared deviation. So we say, this is the deviation for this point, square it. This is the deviation for this point, square it. This is the deviation for this point, square it. We're squaring them, and thus negative deviations and positive deviations both have the same effect. We're both trying to get as close as we can. You then find the line for which the sum of all those numbers is smallest. That's what's called a least squares fit. That's the standard linear regression model. What you're doing is plotting the line y equals a plus bx, where b is the slope. All right? That's what a linear regression is doing. A is the intercept, and b is the slope. So if you just had a and b, you now have information on how strong the effect is. But a and b by themselves don't tell you whether it's a very tight line or a very loose line. And you then have significance measures on that to set it down. So the goodness of fit, the traditional rule is that your independent variable, the thing which you suspect is the cause, is on the horizontal axis, and the dependent variable is on the vertical axis. And the simplest prediction, if there's no relationship at all, then all you say is, as far as we know, y is its average value plus or minus some random number. And you then measure how good the regression is by how much of the departure from that the regression explains. So the R-squared measure, it's called, is defined as the total sum of squares, which is the sum of, this is the sum of, for each point, y minus its average value plus y minus its average value plus y minus its average for each of those points. So that's what you would get if you were just assuming that you had a flat line at the average and were fitting to that. And the question is, how much better than that is it? Well, the residuals are not the distance from the horizontal line, but the distance from the line that you plotted. So the tighter it is, the more of... I may want to go back a bit so I can point at this. Your total sum of squares is basically saying, suppose we drew a line straight across the average value of y. How big what would that those sum squared deviations be? When we go from this to this, how much could we reduce it? So how much of the variation in y is being explained by the variation in x using our line of fit?
All right. So does that mean the lowest r squared value is the tightest fit?
No, other way around. It's the sum of squares minus the sum of the squared residuals. If the sum of the squared residuals was the same as the sum of squares, that would mean you had no explanatory mirror power at all from the thing, and that would give you zero. So high R squared means you're explaining a lot of variation. Right? So what percentage of the amount by which your dependent variable varies is explained by the independent variable? R squared of 0 means you're doing no better than you just assign the mean value at every point, and R squared of 1 means that the regression explains all of the variance. And in fact, R squared is the square of the correlation coefficient, as it turns out. And B is now a measure of the strength of the relationship. So, one of the things you can do is to plot the residuals. The residuals are those amounts above or below. If you remember that scatter plot a while earlier where there was pretty clearly something odd going on. One way of spotting odd things going on is by looking at the residuals, by saying, is there a pattern? For example, suppose it turned out that when you plotted the residuals, they looked sort of like a sine curve. They went up and down. That you had a bunch above the line, and then a bunch below the line, and then a bunch above the line. You'd say, aha, it looks as though there's some further relationship where y is affected by x, but not in a linear way, but in a way that goes up and down and up and down. And start looking for that. There is a form of... What I mentioned, there's a form of statistics which is what's called exploratory statistics, which consists of the equivalent of the scatter plot but much fancier ways. So it consists of ways of looking at your data designed to let you spot the patterns. A long time ago, my sister, in some context, saw a statistics program that was being demonstrated, which was this kind of a program. It's called Datadesk, and it was designed not primarily to do regressions and give you confidence intervals, but to let you view your data in many different ways in order to spot patterns. And she suggested to people who were demoing it that her father was, among other things, a statistician, and that they should send him a sample and see if they could get a blurb from him. And the comment he made on that program was that it was the first statistics program he had seen with which somebody untrained in statistics would do more good than harm. Which I thought was a good line, because statistics programs can often be used for the kind of thing I've been discussing, where you're trying to claiming to prove something and you really aren't, whereas this was just a way of spotting what was really going on. And you can do things like saying, all right, we've got some binary variable, color the men red and the women green or something as points, and then see whether there's a pattern to those red and green points. We can have a three-dimensional cloud, and you can rotate it and look at it from different angles, and that will sometimes show you a pattern and things of that sort. So that's what's called exploratory statistics, which you probably won't do, but it's useful to know it's out there, because you can imagine a case where you are in some kind of litigation where you said, I think there's something going on, but I haven't figured out what it is. And maybe what's going on is that, yes, indeed, electric power lines cause cancer, but they only cause cancer in populations above 3,000 feet altitude. Or they only cause cancer in women at age 14 to 16. Or, so what exploratory studies would let you do is to, without knowing in advance what it is, to go searching for patterns. And if you get a strong enough pattern, you can then get evidence. All right.
That finishes us for today. I now figure out how I'm supposed to put this silly thing. There we go. And and notice that the PowerPoints are on the web page. I have been all along, but these are PowerPoints. So should I have done the whole course with PowerPoints instead of the way I did it?
I don't know if you have to do the whole course, but it's definitely on this side.
I agree. Like, the complexity at the beginning is different than the complexity now.
Now, one could do, even for this stuff, a sort of a mix. You could do something where the stuff that was graphic was on PowerPoints, and then instead of having sort of outline text the way I do, I could do that verbally. That might work better, too. I sort of worry that PowerPoints tend to make it less interactive and sort of more you're watching a movie unless you're talking with somebody.